MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It is a Tuesday afternoon, and as always, each and every Tuesday afternoon, we are delighted and thrilled to catch up with Dr. Ross Walker. Good afternoon, Ross.
G'day, Brent. But look, I'm delighted and thrilled to very quickly put on the line a very famous Australian icon who's here with me in my practice, and he just wants to say a quick hello to you. You know him very well. I'll put him on right now.
Hello, Brent. I'm very embarrassed. Doug Parkinson here.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, we've got to stop meeting like this.
How are you?
I'm a patient of Doc Ross.
Right.
It's weird. And so he said he had the interview all lined up. And so I'll leave you to it. But I just want to say hello again and leave you with my wonderful doctor.
Mate, I hope you're feeling well.
I'm feeling terrific. He's been my guardian angel.
He's a good man, isn't he? Will you look after yourself, Doug?
Thank you, Brent. I will, and all the best with your wonderful program. Bye, mate.
Mate, have a good Christmas. Look after your family, and remember, when you come to Newcastle, let's get together.
Absolutely. That's a promise. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
Bye-bye.
See you, mate. Bye-bye.
Hello, Brent. Just
That's
a surprise
nice.
For you.
Yeah. Did he tell you what happened?
He did.
I've just always loved. I've never met Doug Parkinson ever.
Well,
right?
Can I say I've had the pleasure and honour of looking after Doug for about 15 years.
Right.
And we've become beautiful mates. But he's just such a wonderful, wonderful human being. Just a man. I think one of the best voices, if not the best voice in Australia.
I agree.
So there's Doug, probably Johnny Farnham, the real talents. And
absolutely.
I've had the pleasure of seeing Doug live, and he's just extraordinary.
Well, that's great, mate. Thank you, Ross. That's a treat because I go, as he probably told you, I was just, you know, waxing lyrical about him. I've never met him. I've seen him in a couple of his shows in years gone by, but it was his birthday, and I do a birthday thing and play a bit of music at 12:30 each and every day, and I just said it was Doug Parkinson's birthday today, and what a great voice, blah, 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 blah. And blow me down, Bree said, just after 1 o'clock, I think it was, she said, I've got Doug Parkinson on the phone. I said, nah, you're pulling my leg. She said, no, he's called in. And the rest is history. It was. Yeah, it was him.
Yeah. Well, he's a great man. I love him.
Okay, and we're going to get together. You and I are going to get together. Let's hope in the new year. And I hope that when we all get back to some form of normal and Doug Parkinson gets to come and do some shows in Newcastle, we get together as well.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Dr. Ross, let's talk about this AstraZeneca vaccine. I see they say they're going to start rolling out hundreds of millions of doses in its new coronavirus vaccine by Christmas.
Yeah, and you see the difference between this and the Pfizer one. The Pfizer one, 95% effective. The Moderna one, 95% effective. Both RNA vaccines. Whereas the AstraZeneca is an altered adenovirus, which causes a cold in monkeys, linked to the spike protein of coronavirus. And that's been shown when they tweak the doses. So half strength for the first injection, full strength for the second injection, about a 90% effectiveness rate. Now, really, it's not much different. But the difference between the two lots of vaccines is the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are much more expensive, much less accessible, and have to be put in the very deep freeze for transport and for storage, whereas the AstraZeneca virus, sorry, vaccine, stop saying virus, Ross, the AstraZeneca vaccine coming from Oxford can just be put in a normal fridge. So it's much easier and it's much cheaper, so it'll be much more available. And I'm not in any way demeaning the wonderful work by Pfizer or Moderna to get their vaccine to where it is, but I'm saying we just want to use what's available as soon as possible, and it seems that this one will be rolled out pretty quickly.
You had Greg Hunt today saying that in Australia we look like we'll be rolling out the first vaccines in March.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible,
absolutely.
Isn't
it? So it's not far. And you see, the good thing is, as I say all the time, the coronavirus loves the Northern Hemisphere because of the excessive population in the Northern Hemisphere, the much colder winters, and also the much greater pollution. And so in the Southern Hemisphere, and especially in Australia and New Zealand, we just haven't had the same infection load because of all of those factors that we don't have here. We're now in summer. We're not seeing any community-acquired cases for a few weeks. So what I'm saying is pretty exciting that we can easily wait till March to get our vaccinations. And as Alan Joyce said last night on television, people won't be travelling overseas unless they're vaccinated, and I completely agree with him. So all of you anti-vaxxers out there, I respect your right to believe the nonsense you do believe, but you shouldn't be travelling.
So this vaccine, again, we've talked about this before, but this vaccine or these vaccines, they will not stop you from getting COVID-19 as the flu injection or vaccine doesn't stop you from getting the flu. What it will mean, though, is if you do contract COVID-19, it won't have anywhere near the seriousness and effects that it currently does with no vaccine available.
It may also stop you getting it.
Okay.
So the 90% effectiveness may be a 90% reduction in infection.
Right.
It could be a 90% reduction in the severity of infection, and a 90% reduction in the spread of infection. We're not sure yet. We really just have to suck it and see, have the vaccination and wait and see what happens to the virus. But once 70% of the population has been vaccinated, then we get herd immunity within a month or two, and then the virus is gone. So the way we can get back to normal, if everyone wants to get their lives back to normal, and I don't know too many people who don't, but if everyone wants to get their lives back to normal, get out and have the vaccination as soon as it's available. And I'll be one of the first people putting my arm up to have that vaccination.
You and me both. I got in the lift in my apartment block last night on the way when I came home. And yesterday they've installed a hand sanitizer unit in the lift. And I thought, oh dear, I wonder how long this will have to be here. Or is this going to be here now forever? Is this the new standard norm?
It may be. And the point is, we have to look at the fact that this year we've had much less respiratory infections generally than we had last year. So there's no doubt that the social distancing, the constant hand washing, the shutting down of borders, and especially international borders, has markedly reduced the amount of respiratory infections, COVID or non-COVID, that we've seen.
Let's talk about the virus evolution and could it undermine a COVID-19 vaccine? I suppose this means that the virus changes over time and that could undermine the COVID vaccine. It will need to change over time well.
Yeah, but it's the same thing as the flu vaccine. Every year we have a different flu vaccine. The scientists working on this are very well aware of all these facts, that there's the potential for the virus to evolve into something different but still be a coronavirus. So what they basically do is they want to make sure that whatever vaccine they've got is highly effective at suppressing viral replication, so that's the first important thing, and that it induces a proper immune response after you've had the vaccination. But the key is to hit several different parts of the microbe rather than just work on one area. And we've got to protect against all the circulating strains. So these are the sort of things that all the experts in the area are doing. And the good news is, there's a lot of good news that's come out in the last couple of weeks, that a number of studies have now shown that people who have had the coronavirus and have recovered from the coronavirus, even up to 6 months to 8 months afterwards, over 90% of people are still showing a robust immunity to the virus. So we do hear the occasional case of somebody who caught the virus for the second time or someone who no longer has immunity, but that is the absolute exception rather than the norm.
Now, tell me about this story that at the start of the story it tells about the first drug against HIV brought dying patients back from the brink, but as excited doctors raced to get the miracle cure drug to new patients, the miracle just melted away.
Yeah, but you see, we can't use the same analogy with HIV, which is a completely different virus, because this might surprise you, but HIV, the virus itself, does not cause any infections whatsoever. But what it does do is wipe out your T cells. And the T cells are the part of the immune system that keeps the memory for infections and toxins and everything else. So if you wipe out the T cells, all of these bugs that live in harmony in our body and don't cause any problems at all then become nasty. And that's why how HIV works. So if with the HIV, when they developed the drugs initially, there was incredible resistance occurring against the HIV, but now they've developed a cocktail that just keeps the HIV in its corral and under control.
You've got an article here. It says, COVID-19, who is immune without having an infection?
Yeah, and this is an interesting thing. So they looked at a whole lot of different groups, and they found, for example, that in children, so a group of children under the age of 16, half of them already had cross-reacting antibodies, so which is quite interesting. And this was on blood taken before the pandemic, and they found there were already antibodies against the coronavirus. And so what I'm suggesting is the people who are already immune against it are probably people who are either very, very young children below the age of 16 or people like myself who've got young children around them all the time because I've got 8 grandchildren who get exposed to these kids. Because as anyone knows, the parents or grandparents of very young children, they're walking Petri dishes. They're always walking around with a snotty nose or coughing all over you. And a third of the common cold is a weak coronavirus. So if you have a robust response to that or get exposed to a lot of weaker coronaviruses, you can then build up an antibody response, which in some cases may cross-react against the coronavirus. So I think this is one of the important things about transgenerational living, where older people spend a lot of time with little children and younger people because they are being exposed to more bugs. I know when my grandchildren all started preschool, my poor wife came down with every bug known to man, which is great for her immune system. So when people say to me, never get the flu, never get a cold, well, I say poor you, because what happens then when you come up against a more serious toxin, you get sicker than somebody who gets exposed to a lot of these things all the time.
Tell me about this new saliva-based antibody test for COVID-19.
Yeah,
they say it's highly accurate.
Something developed at Johns Hopkins, published in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology. And what they basically did was after people had been exposed, so this is not if someone's acutely ill and you want to test them for coronavirus. We already have those tests. But this is a test that's done from the saliva rather than taking blood about 10 days after somebody's been exposed or has been infected. And what it does is to see whether they've had a robust immune response. So it's a very good thing for, say, community testing where there's been an outbreak or really targeting vaccines. If someone already has a robust antibody response to the coronavirus, why on earth do we vaccinate them? Because they're already immune to it. And so it's also a good thing for monitoring the response to the infection over time. So you can swab people at periodic times to see whether they're continuing to have a good antibody response.
Good. We're going to take a break. When we come back, if you're afraid of needles, hey, Dr. Ross, in the future of medicine, has got some good news for you. We'll take a break now. It's a Tuesday afternoon and we're talking to Dr. Ross Walker that we thoroughly enjoy, and he's got some good news in the future of medicine. It's if you're afraid of needles, vaccines could come without a jab in the future, Ross.
Oh, yeah. One of the things being developed around the world is this micro-patch technology. And so basically anything that's injectable, apart from an intravenous infusion where you might need fluid with it as well, could be given by this micro-patch technology. So a study came out today showing that they're even considering, instead of vaccinating people with a jab, to actually just put the patch on, which has these tiny little micro-needles that are based around this sugar-based polymer. And it just dissolves the injection, and probably even more effectively than having the jab itself. And so it's one thing. So for people who have a bit of a fear of needles, you've got if you need your vaccination, you just put the patch on for 24 hours and take it off. But also in Harvard University, for example, they've developed this micro patch that, wait for this one, measures your blood sugar level, then delivers insulin based on the blood sugar. So we're talking about the management of diabetes. Forget about pricking your fingers and injecting yourself every day. You just put the patch on and it manages your diabetes, speaks to your smartphone and tells you what's happening. So I think that's really, really exciting. We're now getting a lot of new injectables for a whole lot of different conditions. In my specialty, in cardiology, we have these new drugs called PCSK9 inhibitors that actually pulverize your LDL cholesterol, but you have to be injected once a fortnight. So we're talking about moving that to micropatch technology. We're talking about a drug called inclisiran that, again, pulverizes your LDL cholesterol. That's once every 6 months, which is a lot more doable. But again, just imagine putting the patch on your arm every 6 months. So anything at all that's injected at the moment may be moved to micropatch technology, I think, at some stage over the next 2 or 3 years. I don't think the technology is 10 or 15 years away. It's already being trialed and used.
Fantastic. Bree is a type 1 diabetes. She suffers type 1 diabetes, has for years. She just said to me in the headphones, now that's life-changing.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think a lot. See, I believe that what's going to happen in medicine over the next 3 to 5 years, so we're not talking 10 or 15 years away, we'll look back at what we're doing now and say, gee, they were pretty barbaric in those days. For example, I think another big thing is nanotechnology, where you're on 3 or 4 different medications and 5 to 6 different vitamins or whatever. So the chemist of the future will become the chemist of the past. You write a script, you go into the chemist, they'll put all of your pills into a nanotechnology, released at different times when you need it. You swallow one pill a day.
Wow. Wouldn't that be terrific?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we're headed towards.
Talk to me about, mentioned type 1 diabetes. There's a story here that says most type 2 diabetes patients are at high risk of a fatal heart attack or stroke.
Oh, yeah. And when you do what we call a risk analysis, so these risk analyses is when you basically ask people all the questions about the risk factors, their cholesterol levels, their blood pressure, their risk for diabetes, their smoking habit, their family history. And you can put that into a risk analysis equation, especially if you throw the calcium scoring on top of it. And this particular study showed that I think it was something like 93% of type 2 diabetics are in the high-risk category for a fatal heart attack or stroke over a 10-year period. And what this is really saying is not there to worry the life out of type 2 diabetics, but stressing the vital importance of type 2 diabetics, that they try to lose that belly fat, that they give up smoking, that they have regular checks, that they hammer their cholesterol, keep their blood pressure under control. Because we're not saying you're definitely going to die of a heart attack. What we're saying is you're at much higher risk of a heart attack if you do, and a stroke, if you do nothing about it. But the point is, these days, even if we didn't have all the advances I'm talking about, even if we didn't have that, I can keep people alive to their 100 if they follow the advice they're given.
Speaking of the calcium score, I've been at my wife for probably years now, because you and I have been talking about this for several years now, to have this damn test. So finally I won. She had a test a couple of weeks ago. She got the score back last week. I thought, I was a little concerned. Guess what the score was, Ross?
Zero.
It was zero.
Well, therefore, your wife can totally ignore her cholesterol. Doesn't mean she can ignore what she eats and how much exercise she does, because it's a different issue. There's no really great link, even though people think there is, between diet and cholesterol. It's more you make your own cholesterol in your body. And the point about heart disease, it's all genetic. All cholesterol is genetic. Sometimes they cross over, sometimes they don't. If you've got a very high cholesterol for the reasons I've just said, and your calcium score is zero, your cholesterol should be ignored. You do not need a pill to lower your cholesterol if you've got a zero calcium score. The evidence shows overwhelming there's no benefit. But if your calcium score is above 100, and even if your cholesterol is only slightly elevated, you still need to have it hammered with a pill.
I've got his cynical hostility presents a potential pathway to cardiovascular disease. Yeah. I suppose any form of hostility affects you in some way.
Oh, I don't know. It does. People who are hostile people, there's no doubt. But cynical hostility are people who basically have negative beliefs about life, negative thoughts and attitudes about other people's motives, intentions and trustworthiness, people who are suspicious, and just basically cynical beliefs about other people. And when you think about chronic anger, that's we call that emotional hostility, not cynical hostility. And chronic anger is bad for you. Within 2 hours of getting angry with anyone, you increase your risk for a heart attack by 8 times. But what they did in this study is they looked at the amount of stress hormones that were released during cynical hostility, or people who were cynically hostile on the scale, people who suffered chronic anger, or people who were victims of verbal or physical aggression, otherwise behavioral hostility, and they found that cynical hostility was the worst. So when you see some pain in the butt who's being really hostile towards you or someone else, just in the back of your head say, the universe will bite you on the bum, mate. You'll be in trouble by doing that. So if you're that sort of person, really work on it to try and develop positive attitudes. Stop being cynical about other people, because you're not hurting them, you're hurting yourself.
Do our bodies respond differently to different types of stress?
Oh, absolutely. And look, one man's stress is another man's enjoyment. I've got a patient who's when you jump out of planes, he's a judge, an international skydiving judge. He's jumped out of a plane something like 25,000 times. Now, there's only one way you could ever get me to jump out of a plane, and that's if it was crashing. But that would be terrifying to someone like me, but it's his joy. So it just depends on how the stress is affecting you.
And you, am I right, Ross, in saying that you have to learn how your body reacts to that stress?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the problem with a lot of studies. I mean, studies came out a few years ago saying there's no link between your emotional state and breast cancer, and anyone who's had breast cancer would know what rubbish that is. Because everybody reacts differently, everyone reports their feelings differently on a questionnaire or when they're talking to a counsellor. And as that wonderful Dr. House said on that TV series, he said, all patients are liars. And that's unfortunately in many ways true.
I suppose when it comes to stress, unfortunately, there's no one way that you can fix when you get the butterflies in your tummy and it makes you nervous and you feel sweaty on the palms and all those sort of things. Different people have to react in different ways and treat that feeling differently as well.
Oh, sure. But also, the more you're exposed to something that might be necessary. So, as I said, it's not necessary to jump out of a plane unless it's crashing. And it's better to have a parachute, of course. But what I'm saying is there are certain situations that you need to confront. And the more you confront those situations, the more you get help around those situations, the less the stress is going to affect you. But then there are stressors that we can do nothing about. The death of a loved one, infidelity or a marriage breakup, or having to move. I mean, even moving from one area to a completely different area in your life has enormous stresses that go with it. Incarceration for any reason, serious illnesses. So there are times when there are stressors that you just have to put up with and go through the stress and come out the other side, like we were talking about last week.
Our time is up, as always. It goes quick when I talk to you on a Tuesday. Thank you again, mate, for making yourself always available. We love chatting to you, and we'll catch up with you next Tuesday.
Look forward to it, buddy.
Thanks, Ross.
Very much.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Ross Walker.